purpose of being in the merchant marine was so that I would minimize my participation in killing, that is, direct killing, and to get away from this discipline, military discipline, that I had tasted some of, and I hated it. I really need, and turned out that the fight I was hoping to wage was a very worthwhile one. But as far as finding passports on the ships, I didn't really find any at all. But my friend from Iowa and Jimmy Callahan from San Francisco and myself and Max and Marge, we all showed up in New York. And Max and Marge rented a large apartment in the Greenwich Village right on McDougal between 3rd and 4th. And my friend from Iowa, big, tall, blonde, good-looking guy, down there in that Calypso Cafe and all those places down there, those Caribbean joints, and meeting all these exotic women, he never came out of it. I never got him back on the West Coast again. He sailed East Coast from then on. The whole romance of the Greenwich Village at that time, when there was still, you know, real bohemian community there, plus the exotic ethnic cultural things that were available. And he started going with a magnificently beautiful woman right away. He later married another beautiful woman that we know. She's here in town right now. They're divorced. They had two children together. But he stayed in the movement, at least till the end of the war. And it was this 1944 was my first trip to New York as a socialist. And I watched them all at that convention very closely. And I wasn't too impressed with their lack of candidness, the manipulating ways I found amongst people who were part of the bureaucracy that ran the Workers' Party. Even though it was a small organization, it had a bureaucracy.
One of the different factions fighting for
there were power. Three factions fighting.
Was Maxie Shapiro
was Shapiro
fighting for power?
Who knows whether he had that in mind. What he was fighting for was to retain the ideas of Trotskyism without watering them down with social democratism. That's what his fight was about. C.L.R. James was really interested in the same thing, I think, primarily. And the reason why I stayed in the movement was because of all the adventure things that were going on. That is, I was attracted to this life in New York, too. Can't get away from that. But the Workers' Party was a third camp organization. They had come up with the phrase that was part of the whole approach, neither Washington nor Moscow as a world power. Short for national self-determination for all peoples. Well, as long as people stand for that, my thinking was, I'm sure, that I can put up with their manipulating ways as long as their politics, to me, shows that it's politics with integrity. But from the first day that I was in the Workers' Party, I was part of an opposition, which probably saved me from leaving, because I had something to fight for that would help make, in my opinion, the Workers' Party better. I began to read enormous amounts of written materials. I probably read more in 1943, 44, 45, and 46 than I had read in my entire life prior to that time.
What was your basis of opposition against the bureaucratic formation of the party? Or?
No. In part, but at the beginning, the ideas that I was fighting for were those of, that had been articulated by Max Shapiro, who was known in the movement as Max Sterling. And that was, one, what I've already explained, that is to resist the social democratization of getting involved in other than regular working class politics in the European scene. And two, I was opposed to the theories articulated by E.R. McKinney on American black people. And I supported C.L.R. James' theories and resolutions on what he felt was the proper approach for black American workers to take.
What was McKinney's approach?
McKinney began to pose the question that very slowly that it's possible that Jim Crow can be solved within the context of capitalism, that socialism is not necessary in order to eliminate Jim Crow. And CLR and Max Sterling both said absolutely not. It's impossible to unbed, dig out racism without a whole new social system that's not, that doesn't have a labor force that's marketed. It takes the demarketization of labor force, primarily, I'm saying, to create the set of conditions that will allow the digging out of racism in relation particularly to blacks in the United States. But there was, as far as when I became an auto worker, I quit going to sea. I had made up my mind that I was going to quit going to sea when I paid off a ship in 1946.
You paid off, I mean,
in New York. I paid off a ship in New York. I got off at end of the voyage in New York in 1946. And I was going to come back to L.A. and see my folks. And Shackman and McKinney and Albert Glatzer, who was Al Gates, who was the shadow of Shackman, they got me into the national office by myself, and Shackman put the question, what are you going to do now when the war is over, man? And I said, well, I'm going to go back to see my folks, and then I'm going to sit on the beach. This is like July. And I'm going to body surf for 3 months solid. I haven't been in the water right for 4 years, and I really miss it. I've been promising this to myself for 4 years. And every day after I've surfed for a while, I'll go to the Longshore Hall and I'll get myself in the San Pedro Longshoremen's Union. He says, geez, Fred, we sure hate to miss the boat in Otto. Meaning they wanted me to go get a job in an automobile plant because during the war, the Workers' Party had been instrumental in creating the rank and file caucus. And here was Walter Reuther, now wanting to take over the rank-and-file caucus, and in order to keep Reuther from totally capturing it and getting me the price as high as possible, Shackman was trying to get as many people of ours into Otto as possible to help Reuther in the fight against the Addis Thomas caucus. And they won me to that. And it was a mistake. I would have done far more and far better if I'd become a longshoreman and gotten some time in on the beach. So I came back to the Bay Area.
Before we leave New York, I wanted to finish up with one other question, because I had read that at one point in New York you had worked with an aspiring black writer named James Baldwin. And spent some time with Baldwin, and I wondered if you had what his ideas at the time were in relation to the situation of blacks in the country, and if you had talked with him about the black civil rights and civil problems here in the United States.
Well, as chance would have it, the apartment that Max and Marge rented was almost directly over a new cafe called the Calypso Cafe, run by Connie Williams from Trinidad. And they hadn't even opened yet. She hadn't even opened the restaurant yet. And I got up late, heading for the hiring hall. And I didn't want to go looking for a restaurant. I wanted to get right on the subway. And I saw the door was open. I stuck my head in and said, "Anybody home?" She said, "Come right in, dear. We're not open yet, but I'll make you breakfast." And she made me a marvelous breakfast. And so that became like a home. I ate at least two meals a day there. And when I forgot whether I made another trip or whatever I did, but anyway, I was broke, and she let me be the dishwasher. And the waiter was Jimmy Baldwin, who had just left home months before that, had spent a few weeks in Jersey or so, and was in the village, and was writing, and was about to get a scholarship to write Go Tell It on the Mountain, to get support, not a scholarship, but get was a funding direct to him. His ideas certainly strengthened the ideas I already had. We did not talk about party politics as such much. What we did talk about was simply the condition of life for blacks in the United States. I had never before in my life had access to an African American on a daily basis with whom to have long discussions, and certainly no one my own age. I had known black guys on the ships, but I never was in a position to have a close relationship. The sensitivities that Baldwin showed, and his feeling that racism was far too dug in to eliminate simply by simple reforms, certainly strengthened the way my own thinking and the ideas I was supporting inside the WP. I once asked him to join, and I didn't come right out with it. He knew that's where I was headed. And he said, "No." He said, "You know, none of them have ever betrayed me. They put up probably better fight than most anyone I know from the point of view of not being opportunist." But he was talking about now himself as a homosexual. He said, "The way you people have of handling homosexuals is to bury it and not talk about it." And I think it's the first time I ever heard him use the this little anecdote that a friend comes to visit his friend at his apartment. His friend lets him in and sits him down and says, "Now, I just killed my mother and she's in that closet and I don't want to talk about it." And of course, every conversation they started came right to that closet door. And he said, "And I, because that door is closed, there are other doors that are closed for me in a group like yours."
Well, Baldwin was openly homosexual, not afraid to let people know that.
He didn't parade it. But he didn't hide it. He was, he had met Connie through a famous black artist who was a man already 60 or so. What was his name? He was a friend of Henry Miller's as well, and became a friend of mine. He died finally. He was in a madhouse in the 70s in Paris, and Baldwin was trying to get him out. I've forgotten his name too. And I know, and I have access to that name. Buford Delaney. Buford Delaney. Written about by Henry Miller. And the whole crowd around Miller wrote about Buford, who lived in the East Village then, when they didn't call it the East Village yet. He lived at about 3rd Avenue and 4th Street. In there somewhere. I remember one night I phoned my mother from the public phone inside the Calypso. And there was a lot of singing and dancing and drumming going on and bongos and everything. And Buford was sitting way in the back, away from other people. He was eating still. And I was talking to my mother, "Hello, Mother, how are you? I just got off the ship." And Buford sat there weeping. And I looked up, and when I hung up, I said, "What is it, Buford?" He says, "You talking to your mother." Yeah. And he was homosexual, a very well-known one. He's the one who got Jimmy over to the Calypso Cafe.
But political organizations were not ready to talk about rights for
homosexuals. As a matter of fact, the SWP would expel you if they found out that you were homosexual. And it was certainly not encouraged inside the CP. No radical organization was... I think at that time the Workers' Party was the only one that would tolerate the presence of homosexuals without hard-timing them in any overt way, but maybe by burying, pretending the problem doesn't exist, is the hardest of all ways to treat the question. It may turn out that way. So at least I felt that it was that way for Baldwin.
So now the WP has pushed you into wants you to get into the auto industry.
Oh, I went and got hired at Point Richmond Ford plant, and it was lousy. They were really screwed up. They had they just fired all the women but two and kept them as janitors who worked there during the whole war. And they couldn't keep anybody on the line. It was madness. It was mayhem. I'd come home damn near and faint every night. And so I quit after about 2 months. And then I felt guilty and went to the Chevrolet plant and got hired. Boom, just like that, after only being off a couple of days.
Was there any women at the time? Did the women try to organize the drive to take any plants?
No, not that I know of. Not at all. Here came the GIs home to get their jobs back. Okay, that was the whole way it was handled. And it was about that time I met Mary. I was working in the Chevrolet plant. It was the beginning of the semester, and it was open house. I walked into this dance, and it was Mary.
Richmond?
No, at Berkeley campus. She was a senior. And it was one of the best places to break into the party to meet women. So myself and another guy went, and I met Mary. I had a Jeep I was driving, a brand-new Jeep I bought out of a crate, war surplus, $700. And Mary had a sinus condition. And I had to get rid of that Jeep in a hurry. Or Mary was going to die with her sinuses as bad as they were. So we got some kind of a closable car. And
Chevy? Did
you
work at the Chevy plant?
No, I made sure not to have a Chevy, I mean. Because of that. That's the way most people are. Whoever they work for, they get back at them by not buying a product, you know. Not that anyone ever knows about it, but that's the way it goes. And Branch Life at that time was very concentrated. That is the Workers' Party branch. Met, we're still meeting one and two times a week and working on the assembly. And those of us who were not over in the branch, we couldn't stay awake in branch meetings. It was pure. And the amount that I was reading was cut way down because working on assembly line.
What kind of a job did you have on the assembly line?
Spray painter.
And, were you putting a base coat on cars as they went by? Or?
No, they put me on a finished coat straight away on the assembly line.
And it like, so the cars were moving and you'd spray them?
Yeah, as they move. Ah. Yeah. Well, at first it was fenders, hoods, and headlight rings, and fender caps, things like that. Not wheel caps, fender caps that are bolted to the door at that time. And they went by hanging on hangers. And you were all probably wore this big suit and had a hood over your head and, you know, all this thing in here. And Mary began to be worried because I was spitting all the colors.
She could tell what you were painting.
Yeah,
on
yeah, we had six colors only at that time, but I could spit them all in the mornings. Pretty bad. But then I got a job in a loading dock, which is the most dangerous job in the place. I got hurt out there. That's where I wound up leading a sit-down strike that only lasted about 2.5 hours.
What happened right there?
We loaded new cars into boxcars at that time. And a donkey engine would push up 8 boxcars on one side of the dock, and we would throw this immense steel plate, and so we'd be able to drive cars into the boxcar.
How many cars could you get in a boxcar?
4.
Was it an open boxcar?
No, closed. There would be 2 in the air, like this, that we would raise into the air. And I was a mule runner, that is, you had an electric engine with a big, 2 big pipes on it, and a wheel on the front of it with indentations the shape of a chain link. And you'd set that wheel in the chain and then put the shaft that ran through that wheel into a hole, a steel hole in the side of the boxcar. And you could raise or lower, mainly raise, lower on gravity with ease by hand. Raise the cars into the air, and then they had steel legs that would come down and embed in the floor, and you'd set pins in them, and they were all torqued down with these chains and stiff springs. Well, we wore out 3 pairs of cotton gloves a week on this job. And I became shop steward and was the first beef. I knew that they gave workers in other parts of the plant cotton gloves, and they told us they didn't. So I went on my coffee and stole a pair of gloves from the department I had worked in before and came back and just showed them to the guys. Didn't say anything. He says, I just got these from such and such a department. And that was passed all the way around. Wait, it was fast work because when you've loaded this string of boxcars on this side of the dock, you cross over and load on the other side, and then the train takes out the full and brings back an empty. Well, the only rest you got is what you made. You had to throw a plate and start new every half hour. So it was a very radical job. Guys on it were just fighting the company all the time for life. And I had gotten hurt. One of the legs had been dropped on my foot, and they gave me a job driving cars from the big lot up onto the dock. I'd limp out and get one and drive up and so on. So we had won gloves, but then they began reneging on the supply of the gloves, saying the supplier didn't bring them in and all that. So I filed another grievance for failure to bargain good faith, et cetera, et cetera. And nothing was happening. And the guys would come to me and they'd see me getting out of a car. They'd come running up and show me these gloves full of holes. And they kept after me. And finally, I said to them one day, out of a clear blue sky, I said, look, gloves are tools, aren't they? That's all I said. I walked away. You can't work without tools. And I didn't know that I was doing such an efficient job of agitating. It was an idea that I had, and I had to run. I didn't go run away from them abruptly because I didn't want to talk to them. I really had to go and get another car. And they came to me, maybe a week, two later, and said, "This is it, Red." And they showed me their hands, the gloves full of holes. And I said, "Where are the rest of the guys?" There was only about 20 guys in front of me. And he said, "Oh, they're headed for the clock. They're clocking out." I said, "Hector," he was a young Portuguese kid, just track star, just out of high school. I said, "Get him, Hector. Don't let him get to the clock." And he took off like he saw it immediately. I didn't have to explain anything. And he beat him to the clock and got him back there, and everybody was still standing waiting for those guys to get back. And when they got back, I said, "Listen, if any of us are clock out," and that's as far as I got, a voice interrupted me somewhere in that group of 40 men, "There's going to be some of us never get back in." Another voice said, "But if we're here waiting to go to work, the minute," another voice said, "Yeah, well, the minute they get here with the tools, allow us to do the work," well, we had a sit-down strike going. And we knew the two guys who were most scared and weak of all of us. So we went and pitched pennies inside their boxcar, their empty, so that they couldn't go to work. And I knew we had to have the next department down. So I signaled Louis Guido, who was the leader, rank-and-file leader of the whole plant, had been for years, and was signaling. And he knew that we had shut down the place, and he went crazy. He said, "Hold it a minute, wait."
Did he have a formal position as a head steward?
Not at that time. He would never take anything other than committeeman, steward.
So he's more an informal leader?
Yeah, he was both. He was chairman of the shop committee, he'd be for a year, and then he'd lay off for a year or two. But no matter what, he was considered the leader by everybody. And his prestige and credibility was what kept that local top going. And he came back within 2 minutes to me. "You canvassed the key guys, just like that, blew them in his department." And he had a sledgehammer in each hand, about 8-pounder. He was waving them, "Go to it." And so I went after the other department and said, I sent a forklift driver off to the department before us at the end of the line. And they were with us too. So here come white collars, some suits, white collars. The guys tell me, "Go meet them, Stan." I thought it was going to be it. They walked right by me. "Hello, how are you, fellas? What's doing?" They didn't say where. They kept right on walking. They were just looking. The foreman had disappeared. The foreman ran out of the department as soon as he saw what was happening. I phoned a CP committeeman. Well, he was pro-CP. And I said, "We just shut it down." He said, "You can't do that." I said, "We did it. Now go talk to Flannel Mouth Flanagan," that was the plant manager, "and you tell him what we want. We want these gloves now." He never showed up, ever. This is about 10 minutes to 10, something like that. At about 10 minutes to 12, the foreman returned with a big box, a gross of gloves, Christmas wrapped with a big green ribbon. It was in December. And he put them down on the dock in front of us and said, "All right, fellas, go back to work."
So,
and we said, "After lunch."
So, and actually, it never came down to having to negotiate with anybody. That just the word spread.
That's it.
These guys want their gloves.
And the CPers were really after me. "Did you start that?" They were mad that there had been a sit-down strike.
What about the local union?
No one ever said a word. Management never said a word. Nothing.
You were active at local meetings?
Yes. I was a steward, and I was super active in local media. I was so enraged at the way they were sucking up my life on that assembly line and all of that. And I was a political, and I was supposed to be very radical, and I was playing the role to the hilt.
Mm-hmm. Did other workers see you as a radical?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Everybody.
1946, a lot of wildcat strikes going on after the war.
Not for very long. I mean, the general strike, was it 46 or 47? Must have been 47. I've forgotten precisely whether